How are you?
Oh, I'm good.
Good. So, first of all, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. I really appreciate it. I really have a lot of respect for your work, and so I'm stoked to hear your perspective about many things. I have way too many questions, so I suspect I won't be able to get through them all. Where are you?
I'm in Northern Virginia, in the D.C. suburbs.
Have you attended any of the protests?
I have not attended any of the demonstrations. For the most part, they've been in D.C. I don't think we've really had anything in Nova.
I mean, have you been in touch with people who have been kind of on the ground at any of the demonstrations?
Yeah, a few of my friends have gone to them.
Yeah. What's it sound like? What's the situation?
Well, actually, my friends who had attended demonstrations were more on the other coast, on the West Coast. So it was probably somewhat different. But from their perspective, it was largely peaceful in terms of the demonstrations themselves. People were treating it as any other protest rally, I think. Their experience was fairly positive. I think some of the violence and stuff was in a different location and kind of unrelated to the protest largely. Like, a lot of it was more like crime and stuff like that. But for them, I think they generally had a positive experience at the demonstrations from what they told me.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is the extent, or what's your impression in terms of the extent of rioting, looting, violent mm-hmm. protesters, things like that?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because a lot of people have been discussing it. So people have compared it, for instance, to the 1960s, where in the latter half of the 1960s there was a lot of that. Some people have compared it to Los Angeles after Rodney King's police officers who beat him were acquitted. I think compared to those, it's a little bit different in that I think that the violence is more diffuse. It's more all over the place, but it's probably not as intense. So if you look at like the number of people who participated in, let's say, the rioting in Los Angeles after Rodney King, the numbers were many, many of thousands. And I believe that what we're seeing kind of more diffuse around the country is a much smaller group of people actually engaged in violence. Maybe a few hundred in some cities. Maybe it goes higher than that in some places. And also the nature of it's a little bit different. For instance, like in Los Angeles in 91, 92, like, I think there was so much racial tension between, let's say, African-Americans and Koreans, so there was a lot of racialized violence. I'm not seeing much evidence of that in the United States now. I think it's much more likely that a smaller group of people are kind of exploiting the power vacuum and some of the chaos of what's happening. And also, we have to remember that in the United States, people have been in quarantine for several months. They have not really gotten outside. So I think a lot of younger people who are, you know, they have a lot of energy, they have a lot of passion. So I think some of them are maybe involved in some of these excesses. And that's more on the protest side than the kind of the looting or rioting kind of side. I think that there's a lot of sentiment. If you look at like surveys, a lot of people feel sympathetic to the cause of the protest. A lot of people are supportive of the protests. But in terms of what's happening, I think it can be a little bit misleading to read some of the news coverage and to think that there is widespread violence all over the United States. I think it's in a few places, and it's definitely happening. I think people see it happening in another place, and they feel licensed to do it themselves. They feel some of them even feel it's righteous to do it. But I don't think it's as intense as some of maybe what we've seen in similar situations in the past. From what I can tell, just from the number of people who are taking part, from the amount of damage that has occurred, it doesn't seem quite as intense as those circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't really seem comparable to 92 in any case.
Right.
I've shared a couple things online opposing rioting, opposing violent protest, advocating mm-hmm. peaceful protest. And my impression also from talking to people was that most of the protesters were peaceful anyway. But, like, I got in so much trouble for posting that stuff. People got really mad at me, and it seems like the dominant narrative on my end, I guess, in terms of what I'm seeing and the people that I'm engaging with on the left in feminism, and most of those people, or many of those people, I should say, are not in America, so they don't really know what's going on there either. So these are people from the UK, from Canada, maybe some Americans. Mostly white people, honestly. And they sort of felt that any opposition to rioting, to looting, to violent protest constituted, I think, you know, almost like a right-wing position, as though, so I was opposing marginalized people, and I was opposing the oppressed rising up against the police state,
I mean, I think part of this is that one difference between this and maybe some of what happened in the past is that there wasn't really the same form of communication for people. So, for instance, in 92, what happened with Rodney King is, you know, someone had videotaped his beating, right? And there wasn't, I don't think there was even any rioting until the officers who beat him were acquitted by the jury. It took a long time for that to kind of build up. There was a lot of pre-existing tension, of course, so on and so forth. And it lasted, I think, 6 days, right? I think one reason I would say that this is different and more diffuse from that is that I think the means of communication from which people are associating themselves with the cause, the demonstrations, what's happening, is social media. So now everyone kind of has their turf where they're sharing this video, they're discussing with colleagues, and social media generally incentivizes you to talk to people who generally agree with you, encourages groupthink, and encourages sensationalism. And to where I think that a lot of people, their only engagement with this is just a conversation they've seen online. They feel like they have to perform a certain amount towards other people online, generally comport to their viewpoint online. It's not so much like we're all in our towns and something happened in our town, and then we go and talk to the person to who it happened to, discover who did it, so on and so forth. It kind of creates this kind of monoculture in certain parts of the internet, and it's very polarized, to where I feel like people feel like they are compelled to kind of do that kind of performance. But actually, I think the picture is much more nuanced in terms of the American people. I think when you survey people, there's a very high level of support for the demonstrations. That's one very interesting fact in that I think YouGov did a poll. YouGov's poll showed that I think it was 95 or 96% of Americans believed that the police officers who had detained George Floyd and, you know, had put him in this hold should be arrested under some kind of charge. I believe they asked about the lead officer, who was the first one who was arrested. That's actually a lot of unanimity. Like, that's a huge, overwhelming kind of consensus that was created very, very quickly. I don't know if the exact same consensus existed with Rodney King, although I do think there was a lot of widespread outrage. I think even the head of the LAPD didn't like what happened. But I guess what I'm saying is, I think a lot of what's driving a lot of the social media posturing about some of these activities is the idea that they are supporting some type of marginalized underclass group that cannot have its voice heard, that's being suppressed, that has been stripped of any ability to use anything but violence. But if you look at the level of support for some of the underlying causes, it's actually quite widespread. Even major American corporations and firms are announcing their support, kind of dropping any neutrality they have on political issues in general to say we're very supportive of this, to where it doesn't actually look like a situation where it's only a small group that has no choice but then to use violence. It actually looks like there's a widespread consensus in the United States that there's problems with policing. Those problems should be addressed. I don't necessarily think they have simple solutions. I actually think it's much more nuanced than presented often, but I think there's very widespread agreement that on right and left, Democrats and Republicans, that there are real issues here and that they have to be addressed. So I think a lot of the more radical strains you might see online are people who feel like they have to present it in a very simple manner because the situation is so desperate and they have no choice but then to do that. But I think if you take a step back, there's actually quite a bit of potential for change on these issues. There has been quite a bit of change on these issues. I think over the past 10 years, there's been a tremendous amount of change in criminal justice, and there continues to be. It's just that I don't think that when you're in kind of some of these online arenas that people have any incentive to slow down and present any nuance about this, right? And part of that nuance would be looking at the level of, one, looking at the level of destruction in some places, several hundred businesses destroyed or damaged, and particularly the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And also just recognizing the fact that it's a very small group of people doing this to a large extent. In Atlanta, where I'm from originally, I believe there were just a few hundred people engaging in some type of property destruction, type of looting. My guess is a lot of those people were not even political actors. Like, they didn't see themselves as behaving in a political manner. They just saw an opportunity to engage in crime. I mean, there's always crime in the United States. It's a longstanding factor. It's been kind of difficult to do it under all these quarantines and so on and so forth. But now that there's kind of a little bit of license to it, because so many people are in the streets, a little bit of a chaos, some people just take advantage of that. And it's odd to view a few hundred people in a city of 600,000, which is what Atlanta is, as representative of the 600,000. My understanding would be that, you know, Keisha Lance Bottoms, who was the elected mayor of Atlanta, who was very unequivocal, saying that there's no excuse for any type of violence. It's not honoring George Floyd, certainly. My understanding is that she would be seen as more representative than a few hundred people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that nuance is really introduced when you're in an environment that very quickly polarizes. There's one side, there's another side. You have to signal that you're on one side to keep up your prestige and your so on and so forth. Because most of the things people espound to each other are online. It's like, it's kind of like status games, you know, like people are kind of trying to fit in with their friends and their family and their followers, and they're personalizing it. It's not necessarily constructive political action, right? And I think you see more of that constructive political action, I think, when you have generally conversations that are more inclusive, that are bigger groups of people that aren't just about, you know, kind of posturing one way or another. And I think it can be a little bit deceptive if you look just online, because I think if you look at the surveys of Americans, they have a pretty nuanced view of what's happening now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to me, a lot of it just seemed to sort of lack, there seemed to be a disconnect between what was actually going on in reality, because I also thought it was sort of odd to frame the looting and rioting or violence that is going on as inherently political, because I don't get the impression that it is. Perhaps some of it is. Perhaps there's some, you know, Antifa people who sort of believe that kind of destruction is for political reasons. But of course, you know, people who are just looting shops, I doubt that they're like stealing fans for political reasons.
This gets to the wider issue, which is that there is such a thing as crime. You know, crime is a pre-existing condition for all of this. It is a circumstance where large numbers of police have to respond to street demonstrations, as they generally do when there's very large demonstrations for public safety. It's a very good opportunity for someone who wants to commit crime in that circumstance. I believe in Washington, D.C., someone rolled up in a Mercedes and looted a CVS. I don't think the person in the Mercedes was, you know, going to bring things to the Boys and Girls Club from the looting of the CVS. But there are pre-existing criminal networks, organized crime, so on, that take advantage of this. That doesn't mean that nobody who's doing it has some kind of political intention. I do think there are some people probably involved who think that, you know, spray painting graffiti or something like that maybe is a political act. But for the most part, when you're talking about the serious violence, I mean, there was a gentleman killed in St. Louis, a retired police officer. He was just defending, I think, his friend's store or something.
Pawn
he
shop,
did that.
Yeah,
you know, I don't think that whoever did that saw it as a political act. I think they wanted to get what was in there because it's good to have stuff. And they saw someone defending it and they killed them. I mean, that's my guess. I don't think it does any favors to romanticize it, because then you're kind of misled. You know, there's so many thousands of people doing constructive political work all over the United States on a range of topics. So I don't really see the need to drag in, you know, violent crime into it. It's actually a little bit odd in that historically people kind of on the further right end of the spectrum were eager to portray protesters as violent or as part of some destructive movement, destructive capacity. And I think people on the more left side of the spectrum would respond saying, no, that's a smear, that's wrong, they would never do that. And the data we have generally shows that nonviolent protest develops much more sympathy among the public than violence. There was a really good paper out by a Princeton professor last month that actually suggested, using statistical work, that violence in the 1960s led to the election of Richard Nixon, but that the civil rights demonstrations prior to the violence that broke out in the late 60s generated more support for the Democratic Party and more support for civil rights. But once the violence started, people shifted to the right. They preferred social control. But I think this is part of the polarization of the whole issue, is that if people are mostly talking among people who believe like themselves, they will tend to treat it almost like an Orthodox or evangelical church where you're trying to purify your audience to that point of view. So I don't know if they understand or see the political risk as of glorifying violence, because to them, this is about basically convincing people who agree with them probably on 90 or 95% of things. Like, they say, oh, I support the protest, but I don't support violence. Well, you have to support violence. Well, it's a very inward-looking discussion, when we know, through all the research we have, that generally, once a protest is viewed as violent or destructive, it loses widespread public support. So really, it would be more advantageous for someone who supports the nonviolent demonstrations to separate those from the violence, much of which is just not even related to politics, if you're talking about the wider group of people. But I think so much of this online discussion is really people who are, you know, it's the narcissism of small differences, where it's people who maybe agree on 90 or 95% of things, kind of arguing over very small differences, trying to push their camp into a certain position rather than looking at the big picture. Because I think when you look at the big picture, there's just so much support in this country for criminal justice reforms. There has been, I would say, for maybe 5 to 10 years in that range. There's been a lot of progress made, and there's obviously a lot of public sentiment right now among Americans trying to reduce abuses and so on and so forth. So in that environment, it's best to just kind of take that and run with it, rather than kind of do the extreme tilts. But I think if you're on a Facebook page where it's a bunch of people, all of whom are liberals and left of center, arguing with each other about violence, it's not quite productive, but it's also what that platform like that encourages. So
yeah, I mean, exactly. It's people arguing with each other who, like, fundamentally actually agree about most stuff, and sort of positioning themselves as in a polarized way, which is totally unnecessary. I mean, you know, like, I support the protests, I oppose police brutality, but, you know, to say I don't support violent protest or I don't support the rioting, that's, you know, supposedly, I guess, apparently a major difference of political opinion that needs to be attacked. It seems to me that, and I sort of worry that this is a widespread problem on the left these days, that it's rooted in ideology instead of reality. So I worry sometimes that leftists are idealistic or ideological. They focus on the theory more than what's happening on the ground. And the impact of that often is that they reject data or facts that don't fit the preferred ideological narrative. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the distribution of that particular issue is among different political factions. I think anytime a political faction becomes very inward looking, that's what they kind of do. Like, they give up on influencing wider society because they would rather purify their own faction, or they would rather kind of get them in line to some position rather than be persuasive to a much larger segment of the world. And I think that's not probably exclusive to the political left, probably happens all over the place, but it may be more common among the political left right now. It's hard to say.
Mm-hmm. What do you think if you could guess, I guess we can only guess, what do you think the impact of these protests and demonstrations will be?
You know, it's really hard to say that right now because it just started. It would be hard for us to have imagined in 2014 when people were protesting, for example, in Missouri, what the impact of that would have been. So it's really, it's a very difficult question to answer, honestly. But I do think that it is resurfacing a lot of debates about criminal justice that people had been having. There's also another thing going on simultaneously, which is I think the demonstrations are seen as a wider protest against racism writ large. And that, to me, is probably the less constructive part of it, because it doesn't have a well-defined target or goal. And there will always be like something you can like there'll always be some form of moving target with racism, right? Like you could say you could do a demonstration like that for the next 100 years probably, and you would have something legitimate to complain about. I think probably the police brutality side has more kind of concrete reforms. So, and of course there's some overlap there with racial discrimination, but probably has more concrete reforms, a more concrete trajectory than just like a general strong moralized sentiment against racism, which is a very broad term. I mean, it can mean everything. Today, it's used from everything from people use the wrong language describing, I think the University of California, my former employer, had made a guide one time saying it was offensive to like ask somebody where they're from. Like that could be deemed racism, all the way up to like job discrimination, policing, racial profiling, and wealth gaps, so on and so forth. So that, to me, that side is just, it leads to probably more kind of signaling and posturing and less constructive activity than I think focusing more narrowly on the police brutality. But it's very hard to say where it goes kind of in the future. I think we're seeing a lot of the culmination of kind of ideological currents that have been in the air for past 5 or 6 years at this moment, but it's unclear like what actual long-term the impact they have on politics.
Yeah, I've wondered about that, because I think that for activism to be effective, there has to be a clear aim. And so there are people who are advocating police reform or to defund the police, and then there's a lot of people who are, especially online, who are, supporting the demonstrators, but they're sort of simply saying, like racism is bad, like I support black people. And to me, I'm just like, well, I mean, what does that mean? Like, I think most people support black people and are opposed to racism.
Well,
Like, I
I
don't.
think, part of it is that I think the policing issue has been tied to racism in a way that is a little bit unclear sometimes, in that these demonstrations are set off when someone from an African American background, typically a man, because I don't know, probably over 90% of police involved deaths are men, and same thing with the criminal justice system, so on and so forth. It's actually a very gendered issue, even though we don't discuss it that way. But typically, these incidents are set off when there's some type of brutality or a death, particularly a death with an African American male individual. But the issue itself is not purely like that are targeting. So, a couple of facts like, last year, I think 41 people died in the United States who were unarmed, involved with police. I think 9 of them were African American, right? Which would generally be high, it would generally mean a higher portion of African American men than they are in the US population. But it's not exclusive to that group. And actually, when you factor in, I think when you look at more than just one variable, like you look at the distribution of crime and so on and so forth, there's not a whole lot of evidence that this was like a result of like racial targeting. The second fact is that in 2018, Rutgers University did a large kind of survey looking at incidents of police shooting, and they found that like non-white police officers, like African American, Latino, Asian, are no less likely to like shoot somebody than a white police officer. This is evidenced in the case of George Floyd, where I believe half of the officers involved were from ethnic minority groups. So I think that the issue being exclusively racialized, whereas there are like real problems of racial discrimination and profiling in policing. For instance, traffic stops are probably one of the most well-studied things. Some police officers actually stop less African Americans at night. And why? Because you can't see someone's race at night when they're driving in their car. So there's definitely an angle, but I think that the issue is seen exclusively through that lens. And because of that, the two things are bundled. And I think there is a perception created that if you're an African American person, you have a very high chance of being killed by the police. Like, this is a high likelihood end to your life, right? And that perception has even driven some physicians and public health experts to say, even though we have a viral pandemic, it's not really unsafe to gather in large batches because this threat is so severe that it justifies it. Two things on that. One, I think if you're a scientific professional, you have to run the numbers and give honest scientific advice. It's not really your job to tell people when or how to protest. And that goes in either direction. I mean, let's say they said it was very dangerous, but someone decided, well, it's worth it. It's the worth the risk to me or my family to do it anyway. I think that's fine. I mean, everyone has their own choice to make. But the second problem with this is that they're allowing, you know, they're kind of allowing ideology to override their, like, Hippocratic Oath even. They're highly supportive of this cause. Therefore, the public health warnings go out the window. And I think that that's very dangerous because it's not giving people an honest scientific opinion, because that people should be able to make the choice for themselves whether they're going to be at risk for a political action due to this virus. But they're not being given honest advice about it, because I think the people who are signing these letters, saying these things, they don't feel free to speak honestly as scientists. I think the ideology is kind of corrupting their science, which is a very unfortunate situation, because it doesn't mean that people shouldn't protest. It just means that they should get honest scientific and medical advice about the risk so that they can evaluate it. If the doctors are no longer willing to give that honest advice because they're so supportive of this one political cause, then how are people going to know what the level of risk is and being able to weigh the pros and cons? So there's a number of things going on here. And I think part of it is just that the topic of racism has created such a strong kind of moral pull on a lot of people that maybe they're not willing to kind of step back and weigh risks about things, look seriously at policy, look at the nuances of like how policing is conducted, how it can be fixed. And I think that's just very important in any kind of policy issue that you're discussing, whether it be healthcare, climate change, gun policy. I think when one side just gets so emotionally wrapped up in the cause, they're not necessarily able to risk the pros and cons of different things and look at the ups and downs of policy, which I think is very important, because that's my bias, is I generally think that rationally thinking things through, having back and forths, having large, robust discussions about them is the best way to get to a solution. I don't think you can look just at one kind of corner of the universe and get to the best solutions.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of found it odd that all of a sudden COVID totally fell off the radar, and I've been a little bit stressed about the idea that this all these protests might lead to another big wave.
Well, you know, what's interesting is a few months ago, I read a preprint of a paper. I guess it wasn't peer-reviewed yet, so maybe I should just put that caveat. But I read a preprint of a paper that looked at people's behavior, and I think it was primarily in the UK. I think they had a few US participants in the study, but it was primarily UK. And what they found is that the number one thing that decided whether people were willing to do social distancing and support the measures or not was fear of the virus, you know, which kind of makes sense if you think about it. They didn't take this a step further and kind of figure out how people had that fear of the virus. But my best guess is that it's media coverage. If you were watching the news in April or May, it was nonstop coronavirus pandemic. I mean, basically every other issue of public interest fell off the map. I mean, it was just nothing but the virus. And I think that probably spooked a lot of people, which is why in the United States, I think basically everybody was doing social distancing. There were very few violations in any city ever. It was mass support for these measures. It might look a little polarized if you were watching Fox and MSNBC and they were fighting each other. But really, if you looked at people's behavior, they were all kind of paying attention to it. I think now that COVID has been pushed out of a lot of the news coverage, it may be that people emotionally feel like there's less of a risk, even if intellectually they know the risk is still fairly high. That is a real threat. And I think that's something that people who are producing news should think about. You know, should they think about making sure people continually stay updated on the level of risk of this virus so that they don't just think, okay, no one's talking about it, it must not exist anymore. Because unfortunately, I think that's how a lot of people think about things when it comes to the news.
Mm-hmm. And so in terms of policy and in terms of solutions, what do you think what would you advocate in terms of policy change with regard to, you know, the issue of police brutality, essentially what the demonstrators are?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert about this. I should start by that. But I have reported some stories about it. And I did work on a campaign last year on it was a district attorney's campaign, although it's not called that where I live. But basically, it unseated kind of a quote-unquote tough-on-crime type prosecutor and so on and so forth. I mean, I think a couple things are really important here. One is you need to have good accountability measures within your, whatever your municipality is. So I think we're nationalizing this issue a lot, saying, well, you know, the police are doing X. Well, the police are not one entity. The police is we're talking about potentially, you know, millions of people across a wide kind of industry and many different kind of state, local, federal jurisdictions. The first thing people need to do is just educate themselves about who is their district attorney, who is their like chief prosecutors in their jurisdiction, who are their mayors, the city councils and county commissioners, and what policies are they advocating for on criminal justice. They should look into who is the sheriff who runs the police department. What abuses have been alleged? What are people's records? I think a big part of this is transparency. I believe, you know, I was reading the other day, some people in New York are trying to make people's police officers' records more transparent so that it's available to people, so that people, you know, can know that are there a lot of complaints against this particular officer? Should those be investigated? Have they been thoroughly investigated? There should also, you know, accountability is a tough one, because a lot of these police departments have very strong contracts. They're highly unionized in many parts of the country outside of probably the American South, where they're not very powerful. But everywhere else, they have very strong unions, or at least on the coast, they have very strong unions. And sometimes these unions, you know, shield individual police officers who committed abuses, or they make it very hard for them to get fired. They make it very hard for them sometimes maybe to know the abuse occurred in the first place because of lack of transparency. So I think all those things are important. There's also a matter of, like, we're tasking police to do a lot of things sometimes. I reported a story one time about a Baltimore police officer who talked down a suicidal man who had a knife. The guy was on the street. He was swinging the knife around. It was clear that he was suicidal. He wanted the police to kill him. This is like a whole genre of police killing in the United States called suicide by cop. Because unfortunately, a lot of mentally ill people, they just want to die. And it's a very quick way to die is to go around the street waving a weapon. The police officer talked him down. He convinced him that, hey, I have a family, you have a family, let's not do this. And it was a beautiful thing. It was a really wonderful story to tell. Well, it turned out that police officer did not even have any training about how to do that. He had never had any de-escalation training. He had never been told even how to do that. He just kind of got lucky that he happened. This guy was like a prodigy police officer. He knew how to do it. That's an issue of training the police, but also it's an issue of, like, why is it just that police were dispatched to talk to this person? It would be great if, like, they had an in-house, like, therapist who went with them and was able to kind of talk them down the same way you have hostage negotiators talk them down when there's a hostage situation at a bank or something like that, right? And that's not something you can shoulder just on police. That's also a kind of a social obligation. In the United States, it's a very tax-averse country, right? We don't have very high levels of social spending on things like mental health. We don't have high levels of social spending on things like homelessness, on kind of non-punitive responses to things like domestic violence incidences or robberies or assaults, so on and so forth. And that's like a whole, that's like a society-wide problem. But I do think, you know, I should also pause here and say that we have made a lot of progress on these things. For instance, the New York Police Department actually is one of the departments in the country that does keep good statistics, going back to, I think, the early 1970s on kind of use of force incidents, so on and so forth. In the early 1970s, they were using their guns like hundreds of times, like, you know, 600, 700, 800, 900 times or something like that. More recently, you know, they've used their guns like a couple dozen times a year or something like that, right? So there has actually been a lot of progress here. And I think that's important to recognize, not to minimize what's left to do, but also to tell people that change is possible. And that a lot of that just through training, a lot of that is through monitoring and accountability, can actually be really, really successful. And I think that there's a number of police departments, I think, that can establish themselves with having that record. For instance, well, I think Washington, D.C.'s police department is renowned for its level of progress it's made in terms of accountability, reducing use of force, using alternative means instead of policing. Another example is Richmond, California, where there was a Green Party mayor who really, really cared about this issue. She set about to reform kind of police use of force practices, to reform community relations, and actually they successfully brought down crime and acts of police force together, which is actually the goal, because, of course, if you have a lot of crime, the police is going to be much less sympathetic to what police are having to do to control that crime. So, you know, I do think there are some good examples of this happening all over the country, and we should learn from them, because if we start from the supposition that it's just like, it's terrible, it's never been worse, and so on and so forth, not only is it factually untrue, but we won't have much of a guide in terms of learning what we should be doing in the future. And I think we should always be learning from our history and our past, and also from best practices in terms of the present.
Mm-hmm. So what about the solution of defunding the police? And I think some people don't totally understand what that means, but like, so diverting some funds that would have gone to that budget to mental health services, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was some organization that made an actual, like, official and formal call to do that, and they actually laid out kind of what it means, which was basically don't vote for any increase of police budget. Try to divert some of the funding of police budget to social services like mental health, homelessness, etc. But I think it's kind of a Rorschach test, that phrase right now, and that some people are probably looking at it and saying, that means we shouldn't have any more police. Just don't finance the department anymore. There are some people who are very radical who maybe believe that social media is a place where you can promote radicalism because you don't have to win any elections or actually talk to a broad set of people, just your crowd.
It's like, just get rid of the cops. Like,
there are some people who actually believe that, although almost no Americans believe that, so it's, I don't even know how much is worth talking about that, but just to say that some people will use the phrase in that way. But I think the more mainstream usage would probably be to say, yeah, to divert some of the money from the police department to other outlets of kind of social, social response, which would include, yes, homelessness, mental health, so on and so forth. I mean, there's a couple of things to say about that. I mean, one is to recognize that I think most municipalities are actually very cash strapped, and particularly right now, like states and cities are seeing enormous cutbacks in all kinds of services due to the kind of the recession created by the pandemic. Congress really didn't do very much for states and cities at all yet. Maybe they will in the near future, although it seems like Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, doesn't really want to do much. So who knows whether that'll happen. So I think that right now, it's really hard to actually put a sincere amount of money into the things that we need to just because of that wider economic situation. And I don't know how much moving the pot of money around that we have right now will do anything, because Peter Moskowitz, he's a really great academic. He was a former police officer in Baltimore. He's a kind of a reform type guy. He pointed out that in New York City, the budget on homelessness is about half of what it is on policing, right? So that suggests that, I don't know, cutting the police budget, NYPD budget by 5 or 10% even really probably wouldn't generate that much money, even if you dumped it all into homelessness. And there's probably, 50 great causes it could be going to, right? So the wider economic situation right now, I think, unfortunately, is going to make it really difficult to properly fund a lot of those things, whether or not you cut back from policing. I mean, and the second thing is that it really depends where you're talking about. I think some municipalities have extremely well-funded police who are, you could argue, I think compellingly argue, are overfunded. Other places have police that I think are in disrepair. They take a very long time to respond to anything. They have very few deputies and sheriffs assigned to anyone or anything. I don't know that you could just have a blanket statement that every police department in America needs to be defunded or needs to have its funding reduced. I think you'd have to look at it on a case-by-case basis, which is the reality with policing overall. It's not really even though it's a national issue in the sense that I think most places in America have some issues they could take a look at, but it's not a national issue in that everyone is in the same place. There's actually quite a bit of variation in terms of the quality of policing, the resources of policing, the credibility of policing. So I think this is something that needs to be looked at a little bit more carefully than just making a blanket statement that everywhere in America should be reducing police financing. I mean, some places probably need to be increasing it, given the fact that, there are like small rural towns that have like eliminated their police altogether because they just didn't have the funding to do it anymore. Typically, they're policed by state police instead, but those are not going to be as responsive as local police or as available. So it really depends in terms of that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that policing in the U.S. is racist?
It's kind of like asking, are people in the U.S. race? Because, it's a institution composed of people. Some There is certainly racial profiling. I think I mentioned earlier the study on the quote-unquote veil of darkness, where, like, we know statistically that black drivers are stopped less at night. For obvious reasons, it's much harder to tell someone's race at night. You know, that's the most colorblind time for a police officer is at night, because no amount of bias will determine who they stop, at least not racial bias. Other types of bias obviously can come into play, like what kind of car they're driving, so on and so forth. So yeah, I think there are elements of that, but I think it's often oversimplified. Many of the police departments where you may have seen large-scale abuses, I'm thinking about Chicago, for instance, or Baltimore had some very bad corruption. You know, you'll see that from top to bottom, they're run by people from minority groups. You know, African-American mayor, Latino police chief, so on and so forth, go down the line. And so I don't, you know, it's not a matter of every bit of behavior between human beings is based on their differing racial groups. Like, they're just treating people different because of their race, right? Like, there are many different reasons why someone may mistreat someone or use excessive force or suspect someone. There's like hundreds or even thousands of factors determining that. So it's not that it's not a factor. It's just that it's probably not the only factor. And in some cases, it may not even be the main factor. I think if you look at policing in El Salvador or Nigeria or Pakistan, you'll see a lot of the same problems that we see here in the United States. I think those problems probably arise at any point where you have the combination of institutions that often aren't very transparent or not very accountable, but you're giving people power. And also those circumstances will arise when you have high crime. It's very hard to think of any place in the world that has large amounts of crime but low amounts of police brutality. Because at the end of the day, if police are human beings as well, and they are just as impacted by social conditions as anybody else. If they're on the receiving ends of lots of violence and in terrible conditions, they're not being rotated out properly, they're not getting social supports and therapy and all, so on and so forth, I think they very quickly can turn abusive. There was a study published, I don't remember when it was, it might have been last year, and I think Pacific Standard wrote it up, but basically it was saying that they looked at police officers, and I think when police officers viewed themselves as hated or just racist or whatever, they felt more licensed to be abusive, right? So also, like, building community trust between police officers and those of the police is important for both sides, right? It's important for the population for obvious reasons, but it's also very important for the police, because generally when you set an expectation for someone that's very low, they tend to fall to that expectation. You know, they don't hold themselves to a higher standard. They think, well, people are going to hate me no matter what. I might as well just be rude or hostile or even abusive. So yeah, it's not that this is not an issue. It's obviously an issue in policing and in other areas of society. But it's probably not the only issue, and it may not even be the major issue in many cases.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to switch to a slightly different topic. I read and shared your article online, White People Behaving Badly, which addressed, I mean, primarily the incident between Amy and Christian Cooper. And I also got a lot of pushback around that article. And I mean, it's so funny when, like, I mean, online is just ridiculous. Like, a lot of people sort of commented saying, like, Megan, I can't believe you wrote something like this. Like, you're a white woman. You're doing white feminism.
That's funny.
I know. And I was like, I didn't write this article, and the author isn't white. So, like, good job reading the article. And then when I sort of said that, I guess, so what a lot of people were saying is, I guess they felt, I mean, some people just don't want to see anything that even appears mildly defensive of Amy Cooper. I thought it was a nuanced article, but,
Well, it was funny. By time I wrote that and kind of published it, I feel like the winds had already changed a little bit on that. Maybe had I published it 2 days earlier, it would have been a little bit different. But I feel like at that point, a lot of people were sympathetic to the points I was making at that point, because that's generally the trajectory of these events, is that, and someone's actually studied this, I think, at some point, is that whoever is the target of a bunch of online ire, eventually people feel sorry for that person because they start to see it as disproportionate to whatever they did. And I think by the time I published it, a lot had changed in that regard. So I didn't actually get as much flack for it as I thought. I think, a number of people kind of saw it as a nuanced sort of description of events and saw it as kind of complicating things a little bit, but, you know, not necessarily taking the 180 degree view. For instance, arguing that her behavior was appropriate, I certainly didn't do that. But yeah, I think it was, there's been a series of events that I think even 15 years ago, we would have just looked at that, like if my friend had described that event to me, let's say they were in Christian Cooper's position, or let's say it happened to me, let's say I was Christian Cooper, I probably would have just said, man, that sucked. Like, that was a dumb encounter. Like, you know, I don't like that woman very much. But I would have walked away from it as just an interpersonal squabble between two people. And it certainly would not have turned into some kind of a national event or some kind of agenda setting, kind of political topic that would have been all over the news at every level. I think there's a little bit of, you know, viewing these events now, not as just kind of interpersonal squabbles between two people, but as emblematic of some kind of larger social or political trend, and that's the reason why there has to be such a harsh and overwhelming reaction towards the offender, because if there isn't, more people will do this, and so on and so forth, which I don't think you can prove in any way. I don't think it's actually rational, but I think that's definitely the sentiment or the feeling. And it's really, really interesting. The most interesting part of that saga actually came towards the end of it as it was getting pushed out of the news cycle. Was, I believe it was the New York Times, maybe another publication, but I think it was the Times, who interviewed Christian Cooper. And Christian Cooper actually felt very apologetic towards her at that point. He felt like, you know, he didn't really love her behavior, but he doesn't really have any big problem with her, and he thinks people are being too harsh towards her. And I love that the reporter kept this detail in, because it's something you can easily leave out given how it happened. He started mouthing the words that she was this poor woman, but he stopped. He stopped himself. And they put that detail in the paragraph that he stopped himself. He didn't get the words out. And I always wondered, like, I've wondered since I read that, like, did he do that? Because if had he said that phrase, he felt like people would have been mad at him. You know, he felt like he would have had his ability to forgive her for the Central Park blowup taken away, because he has a responsibility to perform much more outrage than he actually had. Because the average person probably wouldn't be that angry about that. They'd be annoyed about it. It's not like, despite people saying that, like, his life is in danger, your life is not in danger if somebody accidentally, like, or abruptly calls the police on you, or you're stopped by the police. I mean, there's about, like, the same amount of chance of, like, a lightning bolt striking you and killing you as the police just coming and killing you because somebody called them on you. I mean, it's very, very low likelihood, and I think he knew that. I think that's why he felt apologetic towards her. If it was a situation where she had a gun and she was trying to shoot him, I don't think she'd be giving interviews a few days later saying that he thought she was this poor woman and people should sort of ease up on her. He himself didn't feel that, but I think that he felt an impulse, or he felt pressure to not admit that, and I think that's what explained the interview. And I honestly, I found him to be the most fascinating part of this whole thing, because, you know, I think we all know people who are a little uptight and you try to talk to them, and his behavior maybe was a little bit pushy as well. And, you know, if I saw someone in a park and they didn't have their dog leash and there was a law about it, I might just tell them, hey, maybe next time you should bring your leash out, please. But I wouldn't insist on it. I wouldn't start filming them. I mean, that was a little bit creepy as well, honestly. And maybe even he would say that if you asked him now. Maybe he thinks he overreacted. But, you know, I don't – that was pushed out of the news so quickly by this other stuff to where this one didn't drag on over and over like a Covington or some of these other incidents where – you know, 10, 15 years ago, it would have been nothing. It's just like a very minor squabble between some adults or a teenager. But it's seen as a matter of some kind of larger social or political war or conflict. So, yeah, it is a whole genre of story now, and probably shouldn't be, at least not at the national level. I mean, it might be something you'll read in your local tabloid or something. But, yeah, I felt like I was writing that more about the genre of those types of stories more than the details themselves. But I did find actually how Christian Cooper responded later to be quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. I was listening to an interview that you did today, actually. I was listening to it today about privilege and privilege theory. And, I mean, you had a lot of interesting things to say, but I wonder if you can talk more about your perspective on privilege theory.
Yeah, I mean, I think the traditional way these things were discussed were you'd be underprivileged, right? Like, if you think about someone who grew up you know, single parent household, or somebody who suffered from racial discrimination, or someone who was malnourished, or someone who was on the receiving end of domestic violence or child abuse. Generally, I think we have talked about those people as underprivileged, but I think a lot of this theory shifted the onus of discussion onto people who are viewed as not being underprivileged, actually, you know, being in some kind of elevated or elite spot, which has been expanded out to like entire gender groups, entire racial groups. And I think the problem with the theory is not to deny that there are sometimes people have advantages, but those advantages tend to shift around based on social context. And it's pretty hard to say that like being white is always better than being non-white. Like there would be some circumstances where it would be the reverse. There would also be some circumstances where the advantage is so trivial, I don't entirely understand why it's being discussed or talked about. And I think I wrote an article about a study that a woman had performed where she gave this theory to a number of participants. And what she found was that it didn't really change the mind of social conservatives, you know, many of the people who maybe aren't as cognizant about inequality. But it did shift liberals a little bit, but it didn't actually shift them to increasing their sympathy for African Americans. What it did is it made them less sympathetic to poor whites, because I think they started to view their circumstance through the prism of saying that they had all these unfair advantages. And to me, that's one of the fears of this theory, is that it shifts so much discussion to what you view as some kind of elite or advantage group, where you kind of leave out the group that's underprivileged altogether. It becomes about people who are in the kind of more advantaged status, declaring their advantage, talking about it, putting themselves at the center of everything. Even people who honestly, when I look at them, I don't think they have that many advantages or it's worth talking about. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's kind of a problem talking about things that should just be like a human right as a matter of like a privilege. Like it's kind of the language of like aristocracy or monarchy or something. Like, I don't think it's a privilege to like have enough to eat, to not be harassed by a police officer, so on and so forth. And honestly, a lot of this grew out of an essay that was very kind of juvenile to begin with. Like it was very poorly thought out, honestly. If you go back and read the original essay from Peggy McIntosh in the 1980s, where she talks about having an invisible knapsack of all these advantages that you have, if you know what she called white privilege, a lot of them just didn't make any sense. Like she said that, like, you know, your privilege is that you can always find, you know, music from your people. Like this was the 1980s. Like there was tons of like amazing like Black and Latino art happening, like Michael Jackson. Like Prince. It wasn't even true at the time that she wrote it. And I'm not saying that it's not true that sometimes people from those groups have advantages in some circumstances. But it's not true that it's like this all-encompassing like Leviathan that you have at all times. You can't ever shake it. That's just, you know, that's something I think even a child should be able to understand isn't true. But unfortunately, a lot of adults have treated this concept as like a religious axiom or something, which to me is much less useful than kind of the old ways that people talked about this, which was, you know, locating people who are underprivileged through their life circumstances, thinking about how we can help those people, how we can build them up to kind of the full status. Instead, it's a lot of like struggle sessions and like proclaim your privilege, talk about how to check it. And like, I'm not that interested in talking about people who have all these advantages and making them the center of attention anyway. It just doesn't seem that useful. But I guess I think some people just find it to be a sort of religious experience, the same way, you know, some people, Christian evangelicals, talk about having original sin or proclaiming their sins. Like maybe they find some kind of spiritual, you know, evanescence with it by having this theory and by using it, but I've never found it to be super useful in any of the kind of social work that I've done. So,
right. I mean, I don't know if you saw this online, but there was a bunch of people who were sharing sort of a list of privileges that they have as white people that Black people don't have. So one of the things on the list would be like, I can go for a run. Did you sort of see that kind of thing being shared around?
Well, I think I've seen things like that in general. I don't know if I saw that one. But that's another problem. I mean, well, that's another problem of making this like a encompassing theory, which is that you would describe something like, okay, so I've seen is like national parks. Like apparently the composition of people who attend national parks, they tend to be fairly white. Like there are very few like percentage-wise, there's far fewer Latinos, Native Americans, Asian Americans, African Americans who go to national parks. And I think people have generated theories about why that is that have suggested that maybe something is racist about the national park, maybe it's uninviting, so on and so forth. It certainly may be the case that some people feel like it's so homogenous, the environment there, they're less likely to go, and maybe there's some worth in demonstrating the value of national parks to the people in those under kind of populated communities. But as far as I can tell, it's not like you get to a national park and there's something discriminatory there towards you and that's why you're not going. Like, there are actually cultural patterns about things like this that have developed that explain some of these differences. Like, for instance, I don't like the National Spelling Bee. Like, the winners of the National Spelling Bee have always been, for like the last 10 years, I think almost exclusively Indian American. I don't know if something about the National Spelling Bee is structurally biased towards Indian Americans. I would guess not. It's not even the first language of anyone who immigrated to the United States or like their parents who've encouraged them to get involved. But there's just some cultural differences. It's also like Hollywood. Like, African Americans are very well represented in Hollywood. Like, it's a big kind of cultural success story. I don't think Hollywood is structurally biased towards that group and like biased against Asian Americans, who are not very present in Hollywood. It may be that there are acts of discrimination that you can point to, but I also think it's just like sometimes there's just cultural differences and people develop their cultures differently, and they should be free to. That doesn't mean that I think when one group has so many members in a space that sometimes patterns of discrimination and stereotyping don't develop. I think they certainly do. And I would also say that having more people kind of in those elite positions does sometimes move and shift attitudes. Like, the 1990s was a great example in that having a lot more gay and lesbian characters in film and television, I think, encouraged a lot of Americans to see that as normal or to see that as like a part of life. Because just television, some people watch it, you know, and they relate to it and relate to the world that way. So I think all that's true. I just think it's really difficult to automatically assume that, okay, if X percentage of Y percentage of this group is in this space, that means there's something wrong with that, right? Or there's some kind of force that's keeping them out. I don't think that I'm not scared of the great outdoors. I just feel like culturally, where my parents are from, where my family's from, and a lot of immigrants, for some reason, we just don't desire it as much. I don't know why that is, but I'm sure if I spent more time out there, maybe I'd feel better about it. I mean, part of it is just grew up on the East Coast. On the East Coast, we're not as outdoorsy. The majority of the African-American population of the United States is in the East Coast. When I had the opportunity to go to a state like Utah or New Mexico or California, and I have gone hiking and things like that, I have actually enjoyed it quite a bit. But it's just not something I had the opportunity doing growing up in a place like Atlanta, and which just historically happens to be where I'm from. So there can be numerous reasons for that, and I just think we should be careful before assuming that, you know, everyone is scared of some type of racial, you know, discrimination and so on and so forth, and that's what's deciding all of our behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, and I mean, I'm in BC, and BC is a very outdoorsy place, so in Vancouver and BC in general, people do outdoorsy things all the time, and that's mostly because we have access to it, and it's a really beautiful province, and there's like tons of ocean and mountains.
You could make a historical argument that you know, a lot of large African American communities were created on the East Coast, obviously partly due to the transatlantic states slave trade, but that's very different than saying that there's some kind of structure of racism that prevents people from going to public parks. There's nothing that stops you from going to a public park. You can go if you want to go. Your culture may have developed a certain way for historical reasons, but you can also change your culture. You can step outside it. There's all sorts of things that you can do. And I think I just don't want to scare people into thinking that these are very narrow lanes of existence for them, which sometimes the way these things are described is as if, you know, if white people allow me to go to a national park, then I'll go. No, like, I will go based on my interest and my ability to go. Like, I don't really need, you know, white person's permission to do it. And I don't think anyone else really does either.
Right. I guess I feel like one of the big things that's missing from this conversation that we're all currently engaged in with regard to racism in the U.S. And police brutality and racist policing is class and poverty. And I feel like that's generally lacking from the progressive conversation these days, more so than it was in the past. I feel like we focus a lot more on the issue of race and, you know, a variety of other kind of identities, and we don't talk a lot about class or poverty. And to me, that seems like that's actually one of the primary factors in terms of how you're going to be treated by the cops and whether or not you end up in jail. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, I wrote a story about a study, People's Policy Project, which is Matt Brunig's kind of shop in D.C. They did a series of kind of used regressions to do it, but basically what they found is that majority of the correlation between race and ending up in prison actually disappears if you account for other factors, poverty being one of the biggest ones. You know, like, for instance, we don't look at the fact that 90% of prisoners are male, or probably I think a little bit higher than that, and say, well, this, right? Like, you have to generally, to get at the truth of something, you have to account for many different factors, and then see if there's confounding, you know, variables there. So with this one, for the most part, I think there is some evidence of, like, racial profiling with these things. It's always been a little bit of evidence of that. There's also some evidence of gender profiling, by the way. Like, men tend to get longer prison sentences for the exact same crime as women. But that doesn't by itself explain why there's more men in prison than women, right? Like, you have to look at a lot more variables. And I think, yeah, the reality is that, like, most people who are behind bars, they did something wrong. Like, most of them are not there innocent. They did something wrong. And in most states, the majority of people behind bars in prison commit some type of violence. Like, violent crimes are punished much more severely than nonviolent crimes, even though you can find examples of people who have been in prison for a long time for nonviolent crimes. Where does crime come from? You know, there's a lot of debates and theories about this, but social inequality is part of it, and poverty is part of it. Inadequate policing is part of it, drug trade is part of it. There's a lot of things. Obviously, this doesn't determine every single individual's behavior. I mean, people do make choices and stuff, but it's a big part of it. And I think if you have the perception in your mind that if you had 100% unbiased policing and juries that this would all disappear, you're probably wrong, because most people who are behind bars did something wrong, right? And why did they do something wrong? Well, human behavior comes from all thousands of factors, but certainly growing up in a single-parent home, not having access to good, decent nourishment, also the presence of lead. There's a lot of really good research now. The heavy presence of lead in American cities was very correlated to criminal behavior. I think it, like, lowered people's inhibitions and made it hard for self-control and things like that. All these factors are driving crime rates that are driving incarceration. And I don't think you can look at incarceration without looking at crime. I don't think you can look at crime without looking at kind of broader social trends that help create an environment that makes crime easier. I'm not being totally deterministic and saying, well, just because these conditions exist, you have to be a criminal. It's like, no, that's not true at all. But there is a certain amount of, like, yeah, you choose your path, but the paths are, right? If we give people more paths, you know, who knows what happens. And I think the singular one variable explanation of crime, policing, and incarceration has been very just unsatisfying. I'll give you an example. So now it was 2018, but Wisconsin had a governor's race 2018. The Democratic candidate promised to cut the prison population in half. I think the Republicans countered, actually, you can't do that unless you, like, release some violent criminals. Like, you're basically saying you're going to let out, you know, the rapists and murderers, blah, blah, blah. So the Democratic candidate kind of backed off it. Like, you're like, okay, maybe not half. But it gets to a lot of the questions here, which is it's much more complicated than just saying it's a matter of, you know, discrimination. It's the new Jim Crow, which the thesis of that book is mostly wrong, actually, even though I do have a lot of respect for Michelle Alexander, the author. you know, these are difficult problems to tackle in a country that has as the United States, and it's very difficult to tackle without dealing with social inequality, child poverty, so on and so forth. But those issues so often are just not linked to this at all, even though they're exactly linked to it. They're just not linked to it in popular or elite discussion enough.
Why do you think that is? You know, why are we failing to talk about class and poverty?
I mean, I'm not sure I necessarily have a grand theory about it. In general, Americans are not super comfortable talking about those things. In general, America has a Protestant work ethic, a libertarian ethos. In a place like England, they talk about social class all the time. Like, they're always, like, you know, there is a broad, like, feeling of, like, class tension or how these social classes unfortunately end up defining people. In the United States, people like to say they're all middle class. Like, you know, it's like a broad kind of consensus. And even a lot of the people who are proposing criminal justice reforms and supporting for them and advocating for them, I think they've done a lot of good work, but a lot of them tend to be like themselves of high class status. So like the Kochs, right? Like the Kochs have spent tons and tons of money on criminal justice reform. I think a lot of that has been good, but it has its limits if you're not willing to seriously deal with things like poverty and social inequality. And Kochs certainly are not interested in that. They're libertarians, right? Like they don't believe in any kind of government social welfare. Or I think one of them ran for president in 1980 as a libertarian, like they wanted to eliminate Social Security and Medicare. Like they didn't want to cut it back. They wanted to eliminate it. They just didn't find it to be a valid concept. And I think a lot of the celebrities, you know, maybe they can relate to somebody who is African-American or Latino behind bars, but maybe they cannot relate to somebody who grew up in a single-parent home and in a high-crime neighborhood with a terrible school. You know, that's much harder to relate to because you're not just talking about skin shade. You're talking about a whole set of life experiences which are somewhat alien to them. I mean, perhaps that is part of what explaining why this discussion has shifted in one way versus the other, although I don't entirely know. I think it probably just has to do with the fact that these are issues that are just rarely ever seriously addressed in America. And it's probably addressed through what people are much more comfortable talking about. You know, there's a very strong taboo, for instance, about racism in the United States, like among industrialized countries, as there should be very negative attitudes about racial discrimination. There isn't such an attitude or other things. Like, there have been so many corporations that are putting out the slogan Black Lives Matter. I don't know if these same corporations would put out the slogan about, you know, rich people should pay their taxes or universal health care or, you know, like, it's not really what they're organized to do. It's not very threatening to them to just say Black Lives Matter because, you know, pretty much everyone can agree with that. Like everyone can, unless, you know, you have a reactionary just kind of knee-jerk reaction, which is just to phrase it differently, you know, with all lives matter stuff. But like still, most people agree with the underlying, like, yeah, of course they do. Other than some silly tribal culture war signaling, everyone agrees with that statement. It's not really threatening anyone's kind of power in any way. And so it's very easy, I think, for people in the United States who have a lot of power to just go with that. But it'd be very difficult for them to say, well, everybody in America should be in a union, you know, like Amazon should be unionized, Walmart should be unionized.
Totally.
So on and so forth. That is just very, very difficult in a country that doesn't really consider social class very much. And where just, I think the richest people just have a extremely outsized voice in politics beyond, you know, probably most other similarly placed industrialized countries.
Yeah, and I mean, I would argue probably that people who are middle or upper class are more prominent online. So, I mean, yeah. They've really enjoyed, I think, being able to post Black Squares on Tuesday or post Black Lives Matter on Instagram, which, you know, like, as you say, that's not a radical thing to say. That's not really going to offend very many people. And you know, sort of be able to,
and the people who it does offend is like, it's like just like normie people, like, you know, it's not like the power elite of America, right? Like it's just like a very level culture war signaling, like the, you know, happy holidays versus Merry Christmas type stuff. Like it's at the very lowest level of challenging someone.
Well, yeah, and you're doing it on a platform that's like, it's a corporation, like Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. Like, I mean, at the end of the day, in many ways,
they all support that view. Like, they themselves have established that view in their own public statements. Right. So,
right,
it's like the official view of the platform. You're not actually rebelling against. And I'm not saying that it's not valid if it's not a rebellion. I'm just saying, but it just isn't. Like, and I think some people treat it as if it is. They feel a sort of internal emotional rush as if it is, but it's not really. So
yeah. So where do you fall on the political spectrum?
Oh, I mean, I don't think anyone can look at my resume and say, you know, that I'm typically, you know, center left, at least. I think people would generally look at my body's work and say that.
Mm-hmm.
I think, maybe a couple things I'm more center right, like particularly compared to an international audience, I probably believe in gun ownership a little bit more, or the right of gun ownership probably a little bit more than some of the people in the international audience. But, you know, I grew up in the American South. That's what one of my friends told me once when I was telling him this, like, you know, it just kind of goes with the territory. But generally, like, yeah, right, center left is where I've been, although I don't really like labels that much, because I, you know, when you put up something like that, people already have a bunch of associations with it. So, you know, if I was forced to try to put myself, you know, thinking about all my views, that's probably what I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess I've, you know, always for a long, I don't like labels anymore either. So I sort of try to avoid them nowadays and try to just talk about ideas and policies and have conversations. But I do advocate a lot of socialist policies, and I've long mm-hmm. identified as a socialist, but I've started to be accused by a lot of people of moving to the right, because I think, you know, I'm having conversations with people who might not be pure leftists, or because I'm yeah. saying things that people sort of associate with the right for whatever reason, mm-hmm. or, you know, I'm sort of straying from the party line in a lot of ways. Is that kind of happening to you? Are you having that experience?
Well, it's interesting. Like, so Liliana Mason is a professor at University of Maryland. She studies polarization. In my previous work, I certainly used a lot of her research, interviewed her. What she finds is that polarization is not actually based on what you believe. Like, it's not actually based on, like, the set of issues and, all right, I feel this on gun control, I feel that on. She actually found that people who just have disagreements with each other about policy issues are less polarized than a different group of people who maybe are actually closer on the issues. And that group of people are people who identify very strongly with, like, a label or a tribe. So, like, let's say you're a very strong liberal. You're going to be more polarized against people who identify as conservative than you would as somebody who doesn't identify as conservative, but maybe is further away from you in terms of their actual, like, beliefs on the issues, right? Like, that it has this kind of team sports mentality, but that team sports mentality really doesn't have anything to do with where you are politically. Like, you can be very far to the left, but not very polarized. You can be very, like, you can be like a lifelong Republican voter, but not like have any problem talking to, like, a Democrat or a liberal. That's not actually polarization. Polarization is really based on how strongly you identify with the tribe and you hate the other tribe. It doesn't have anything really to do with what you believe. Like, it doesn't mean you're less left wing at, like, you have, like, a Republican friend or something, right? And vice versa. So I think that's very, very important to know, because some people interpret it that way, but they're interpreting it that way because they're misinterpreting politics. Like, politics is about accomplishing and achieving things together, like policy and so on and so forth. It's not really about, like, sorting your tribe, or that's more like social grouping. It's more like high school gossip or something like that. But unfortunately, I think in the United States and parts of the Western world, a lot of it has become that, because it's like the Facebookification of politics, where, like, you know, you have your wall and your feed, and you have your friends, and, like, you're trying to sort them, and, like, but none of that really has anything to do with accomplishing or, like, achieving anything in politics. That's like a totally different thing. But I think when so much of it's personalized and it's all about being with your kind of cohort, people can make that mistake.
What's one thing that you would change in the U.S. right now? I know that it's hard to choose one thing. I know that things are yeah. much more complicated than that. But, you know, it's good to have simple goals and simple aims to try to, you know, get people on board. So what's one thing that you would sort of pick?
Yeah, I mean, Something I've been interested in for a long time, and it kind of relates to what we were just talking about, is, you know, U.S. political system itself is kind of set up to have this us versus them mentality, like Democrats and Republicans. And a lot of people are voting based on, like, oh, I like Donald Trump's personality. He's a tough, you know, business guy. Or, you know, I like Joe Biden's a decent man. A lot of people say he's a decent man. I think he's a decent man, too, by the way. But, you know, a lot of people say that. I think this electoral system itself is kind of creating that effect. I'd prefer if the U.S. had a proportional system, like a parliament like Germany or Sweden or Israel, where we had, you go to the polls and basically vote for whoever you want. Whatever percentage your party gets, that's how many seats they get in Congress. And then Congress works together to elect the prime minister, depending on how many seats were elected. And that way, you wouldn't have two major parties. You'd have maybe six or seven or eight. People will be voting for a party, which means the parties would have some incentive to be ideologically kind of motivated, to be putting out their ideas and contesting ideas against each other. It wouldn't just be about, you know, who's the dude and, all right, there's one good party and one bad party, which a lot of partisans on both sides believe. And it would give a lot of freedom to people to, like, think that, like, like Donald Trump, I think a lot of conservatives I know really don't like Donald Trump. Like, they think that he has, like, a bad personality, a lot of bad individual characteristics. But they say, this is the only way I can vote if I'm not a liberal. Like, if I don't support abortion, I have to vote for Donald Trump. But if you had a multi-party parliament, proportional system, there might be four different conservative parties all competing against each other. And if one of them gets deleted, like Donald Trump, you don't have to vote for him. You can vote for a different conservative party, and your vote will still matter. It will still be tallied up, even if it's just 5%. You'll get some seats in the Congress. And it's much better than our system, which is called first past the post. You have to win a majority or plurality, generally clusters around two parties. A lot of people don't even like the two parties. So that's probably the number one national policy change I would make. I think that national policy change would make our democracy much healthier. It would make it much easier for us to accomplish a lot of the other goals that we have in mind.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I agree. Thank you so much for talking with me. It was super interesting. It was great to connect with you. I really appreciate your work.
All right. Thank you so much, Megan.
Cool. Have a great night. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. I'm Megan Murphy, host of The Same Drugs. Thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode and are enjoying the other interviews and the content we're producing, please do consider becoming a patron. Just head over to patreon.com/Megan Murphy and sign up. 5, 10, 25 bucks a month. It all helps. We rely entirely on supporters and donors like you to keep doing this work. Thank you so much. We'll catch you next time on The Same Drugs with Megan Murphy.